Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, they finally did it. Facebook is going to go public. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 1st of February. Good to have you with us. The most mentioned company in business and the markets today was one that doesn't even trade publicly yet, but they're going to real soon. Facebook filed papers for its initial public offering this afternoon. We've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the line for a little bit of context. The first question of which, Heidi, is this one. You ready?
I'm ready.
So what? I mean, what's the big deal?
Sure. Well, think about it this way. It is hard to get 845 million people to agree on anything. We can't even get our Congress to agree, right? But that many people have signed up for Facebook. So this would be by far the biggest tech IPO in history. It's a cultural milestone. Everyone we know is on Facebook. And it also, this company has spawned an ecosystem. There are other companies that have depended on it. You know, Zynga, Twitter, and Tumblr users tend to be Facebook users as well.
I saw a great caption to something the other day. You mentioned Zynga, the company that makes Farmville. Facebook betting the Farmville. But anyway, I digress. All right. Now that they've filed, though, what ought we look for? What do we need to know?
Sure. Well, what we know now is roughly how much Facebook is worth, and that is a whopping $100 billion. Yeah, they're going to try to raise about $5 billion. And we're finding out that they are doing very well in terms of revenue. They grew their revenue 88% from last year to this year. So they're making $3.7 billion. So we know they're doing well on that front. But there are other things that we still have to watch and learn and read more from this filing. And that is, how does Facebook hope to make more money in the future? What is their strategy? Will most of their money come from online ads? Who are its competitors? It mentioned a few in the filing, but none of them are really ones that you might take seriously. They mentioned a company called Cyworld, which I don't think we've ever heard of. Right?
That is, yeah.
Right. We know it's not MySpace, but who else is it?
That's right.
And, and then as the further filings come on, we'll find out how much people are paid, you know, what their stock options are.
Right.
And the one twist here is that Facebook is one of the few companies that already has a lot of mutual funds that hold shares. As many as 50 mutual funds already hold shares in Facebook. So you'll be able to see if you have a teensy stake in it through your 401k.
Yeah, that's actually a key point. I mean, it's been said that Facebook's a private company, but only kind of, because lots and lots of big institutional investors have a slice of this thing, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, they know everything about you. So now you get to know a little about them.
A little bit about them, yeah. One of the other things that companies have to do when they file for an IPO is lay out the risks, the downside things that could happen. What do we know based on the filing today?
Sure. Well, Facebook mentioned a lot of risks. Now, the thing is, companies mention every single thing that's possible. Zynga, for instance, mentioned that it was on an earthquake fault line. So they have to cover everything, an asteroid hitting the Earth. So Facebook mentioned that it has risks to its brand. You know, what if people don't like it anymore? Its issues with privacy. We know those have been a problem. If they get to be bigger, it's going to have to deal with that. It mentioned in passing the possibility of hackers or third-party interference in its servers. Can it keep users and grow them? That's another one. So it's those types of things. Mm-hmm. What is its future? And those are the risks that you want to pay attention to. Right now, they're vague.
And it's all going to have to be in paperwork, right? Because just to point out and remind people, executives now at this company are in the quiet period and they really can't say anything, not that they've said a whole bunch in the past.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's been the worst kept secret so far, but they're really going to have to be quiet
now. All right,
now.
Heidi Moore in New York. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, so as Heidi mentioned, Facebook has more than 800 million users, which is a not insubstantial chunk of the entire population of the planet. Facebook, as Heidi mentioned, also knows all kinds of things about its users, where they live, what they like, where they work, who their friends are, and oh, so much more. It sells all that information to advertisers, and it's probably making billions of dollars doing it, as we learned from Heidi. Here's the thing, though. As a public company, Facebook is going to have to grow all the time. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that slice of the story.
Ads on my Facebook page, discount designer dresses, a book about Downton Abbey, my new favorite TV show, and a miracle weight loss powder Kelly Ripa apparently uses. I sometimes click on these ads. I mean, who's thinner than Kelly Ripa? But apparently, lots of my fellow New Yorkers don't.
No, never.
No, I don't.
No,
I don't. No.
No.
Sometimes I
maybe once or twice, but I always wondered if that was a virus.
No, that wasn't a virus. It was the main way Facebook makes money. And once it becomes a public company, being ignored could be really expensive. Forrester Research analyst Nate Elliott says Facebook is going to need everyone to pay attention to the ads if it's going to grow at the pace it needs to.
The primary way that they make money is by selling relatively simplistic little advertising badges to marketers. Facebook needs to go deeper.
Deeper?
You know, it's like saying we know that you live in New York, so we're just going to serve you ads targeted to New Yorkers. But the fact is there are a dozen other facts about me that might make a different kind of advertising relevant.
Elliott says Facebook needs to figure out what makes us tick. The social network's new timeline layout is a step in that direction, says Justin Smith with Inside Network. Timeline takes all your Facebook information and organizes it into, well, a timeline, so advertisers can track your behavior through the years.
Facebook could target advertisements towards, you know, a much broader set of life events than they do today.
With Wall Street to answer to, Smith says no life event will be too insignificant to count. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more stocks up than down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, the president filled in the details of his most recent mortgage relief plan to give a thumbnail sketch of it back at the State of the Union. We now know he wants to spend as much as $10 billion to help homeowners refinance their mortgages into cheaper interest rates. Even families whose homes were underwater, that is, not worth the mortgage they owe, would for the first time be eligible. And the White House says that would help more than just the housing market. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Underwater homeowners can't take advantage of record low interest rates because lenders won't refinance when a home's value is less than the loan. The president is proposing to expand government backing for underwater refinancings, paid for with an extra fee on big banks. He says the average family savings of $3,000 a year will ripple through the entire economy.
You'll be able to save hundreds of dollars a month that you can put back in your pocket. Or you can choose those savings to rebuild equity in your homes, which will help most underwater homeowners come back up for air more quickly.
The White House says homeowners who don't have access to cheaper mortgages are less likely to spend and become a drag on the economy. But while the government incentives for refinancing saves money for homeowners, it won't be a total win for the economy. Mike Moran at Daiwa Securities America says there'll be a corresponding loss for lenders.
Because there's some investor somewhere in the economy that's earning the interest on that mortgage, and they're going to be getting less interest income than they were before.
Between those investors and struggling homeowners, who's more likely to spend that income right away? For Housing Secretary Sean Donovan, that's a no-brainer.
For the average family, $3,000 more a year in their pocket, every year they pay their mortgage is like a significant tax cut and would boost consumer spending.
And, he says, makes it more likely that family can afford their monthly mortgage payments, avoiding more foreclosures in the future. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So those are the details and some expert analysis. But what do actual people think? Can the government fix the foreclosure crisis? Do Americans even think the government should be messing in the foreclosure crisis?
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's with us every week for Attitude Check, our look at what Americans really think. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So as we just heard, the president is going to spend $10 billion, wants to spend $10 billion to fix the lasting foreclosure mess in this country. You guys have asked around about how people feel about the government trying to fix foreclosures. What do we know?
Well, the majority would favor doing exactly what he's doing. 58%, in fact, say yes, the government should get involved, should try to stop the rise in home foreclosures this year. 34% say what Romney said before, but I think he's quit saying it now, and that is to let the market work its will. So all in all, you put it together, you would get approval for what the White House is doing.
That's actually kind of interesting because you and I have spoken before about how people distrust big government by a lot in this country.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the fundamental paradox we see in American politics today. Americans distrust the government. Yet when you just say there's a bad problem with foreclosures, should the government try to fix it by itself? Americans say, sure, at least the majority say, sure, they should. I should note, Kai, Republicans don't think the government should do it, but they're swamped by independents and Democrats who say the government should.
Right. That was my next question. So I'll skip down on the list a little bit and ask you if there's a difference when you break it down, not by political leaning, but by economic leaning. Does it matter whether people are low, middle, or upper income, how they answered that question?
The richer you are and the higher your level of education, the less likely you are to think that the government should be involved. That's another paradox, because at the upper end of the socioeconomic scale, we actually have more Democrats in today's American society. And yet people with the highest incomes in our Gallup polling, and also the people that have college educations, are the least likely to say that the government should get involved in trying to fix the foreclosure mess.
Let me back you up for a minute. At the upper end of the income strata, we have more Democrats in America today?
Oh, yes. Those are the Hollywood elite, we call it, somewhat facetiously. But yeah, you're right. In general, you know, lower socioeconomic status people gravitate to the Democratic Party. But if you have a postgraduate degree in American society today, those people are significantly more likely to be Democratic in political orientation.
Interesting. One more question for you, Frank, and this is a little bit sideways, just on the topic of people believing in the housing market. Obviously, a lot of news this week about the Case-Shiller Index yesterday and all that stuff and the president today. How do Americans feel about whether their house will eventually regain its value?
57% of homeowners say they are worried about the fact that their house will not increase in value and regain its value. And we looked at that on a relative basis with a bunch of other worries. The number one thing people are worried about in this country is the economy in general. But that, for homeowners at any rate, that worry about their house is much higher than their worry about getting laid off. It's much higher than their worry about losing health care coverage. And it's about the same as their worry about not having enough money to retire. Mm-hmm. So it is a really significant issue out there in the American public, at least the 66% who own houses.
Right. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. You can find more about it and some data on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Today was a mercifully quiet day on the campaign trail. After Florida last night, the four Republican hopefuls have moved on to Nevada. The caucuses there are on Saturday. Nevada is one of the two states we're taking you to this week to shed some light on what really matters in this election, the real economy. Nebraska is the other state where farmers and the federal government have had a complicated relationship since at least the Great Depression. Agricultural subsidies are a big election issue in the Cornhusker state. And with all the new worries about the federal deficit, farmers are anticipating a change. From Carlton, Nebraska, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Brad Henricks sits in the driver's seat of an 18-wheeler. He's a farmer in his late 20s hauling corn to an elevator, a grain storage facility. And I'm riding shotgun. Henricks pulls onto a scale, and we weigh in.
Okay, this time you're going to go to the south elevator. You'll dump in bin 5.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few hundred feet further, and Henricks jumps out. Cranks open the hopper, and kernels flow through a metal grate beneath the truck. Some 80,000 pounds of corn rush down, then up, into a concrete silo that towers above us. At today's price, this load alone is worth close to $9,000. And some of what it costs to grow that corn was paid for by us. Taxpayers have subsidized agriculture in the U.S. since the 1930s. But Henricks, like a lot of farmers I talk to, says the subsidy system is changing.
You know, the farm safety net that my dad used and the farm safety net that my grandfather used will look totally different in 5 years.
Right now, it's a pretty sturdy net that's woven out of low-interest loans and government-backed crop insurance. And then there are direct payments, $5 billion that's doled out to farmers every year based on how much land they own and what they've grown in the past.
Those are direct payments that will come to a farmer pretty much no matter what the conditions are. And those are probably the best guess are going to be lost.
That's Don Hutchins, the president of the Nebraska Corn Board. That direct payment program started in 1996. It was supposed to be temporary. But when lawmakers wrote the 2002 Farm Bill, the agricultural economy was in bad shape, so they made them permanent. This year, Congress is supposed to write a new Farm Bill. And even though Hutchins lives in Lincoln, he can read the writing on the wall in Washington. There's concern about the deficit. And Hutchins says the farmers he works with understand that.
You know, if there's going to be cuts in farm programs, they want to see those corresponding cuts in the federal spending level as well.
The Henricks family farms just down the road from the grain elevator, maybe a mile away. Brad shares equipment, including that 18-wheeler, with his dad and his brother Landon.
I'm for change as long as everybody changes a little bit.
Landon Henricks is a couple years younger than Brad, but he's been farming longer.
I think that, yeah, there needs to be budget cuts. I don't know how come you can't balance a budget, because everybody on their day-to-day operation has to balance a budget.
Both brothers say they want to see cuts or changes to social welfare programs, including Social Security. Brad Henricks says commodity farmers are willing to do their part to reduce the deficit. Right now, they're making good money from the market.
And I think that's something that farmers want. You know, they want to be able to not necessarily have to depend on the government for their income.
But they still need some kind of protection, he tells me, in case corn prices tank or there's a flood. Those direct payments may disappear, experts say, but subsidized agriculture isn't going anywhere. The way the government subsidizes will change. Brad Henricks says today crop insurance is the most important part of the farm safety net. And last year, that federally subsidized program paid claimants more than $9 billion. In Carlton, Nebraska, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A note and a retraction now about our broadcast on Monday. A commentary we aired by a man named Leo Webb as part of our commentary series named, ironically enough, My Life is True. Mr. Webb claimed to be a returned veteran of Iraq, an Army sniper, while he was there. The Army told us this morning they've got no record of a man named Leo Webb ever serving. Far more trivially, he said he pitched in the minor leagues for the Chicago Cubs. They also have no record of Mr. Webb. Our obligation to you, to ourselves, and to our local station partners is clear: to provide accurate information in context without conflict of interest. We didn't meet that obligation in Mr. Webb's case. We retract his commentary completely, and we apologize. Coming up, yeah, no, I know it's weird. Think Darth Vader. It'll make sense in a little while. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 83 points today, 0.2%, ended at 12,716. The NASDAQ tacked on 34 points, 0.1%, closed at 2,848. The S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.9%. Closed at 1324. Shares of Whirlpool gyrated up nearly 13.5% today. The world's biggest appliance maker reported a drop in quarterly sales, but an optimistic outlook for 2012. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar trudged up 0.3%. Financials did all right. Shares of Morgan Stanley rose nearly 4%. Citigroup bulked up 0.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.83%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary report on fourth quarter productivity and costs. The House Committee on the Budget holds a hearing on the state of the U.S. economy with Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. And do you want more snow or are you ready to thaw out? The groundhog will let us know which it is. My advice, don't leave your vacation plans up to him. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The housing plan the White House came out with today follows in line with what the president proposed in the State of the Union this week, trying almost anything to get the economy going again. Commentator Amity Schles is a little worried.
Carrot and stick, stick and carrot. The pair represents an age-old tool for changing behavior. President Obama plans to build much of his election year policy agenda around carrots and sticks. In Obama's world, businesses and business people are the rabbits in need of behavioral change. Obama wants to reward companies that create jobs here in the United States. One of the carrots is a tax credit for companies that move operations back here. Another would double tax breaks for high-tech factories making products here. These are juicy carrots, but the sticks put forward by Obama are hefty. The president wants to eliminate a tax break for moving expenses when a company ships operations overseas. He also wants to close a tax loophole that allows companies to move some types of profits to overseas tax shelters. The president figures that businesses will tolerate the pain of the sticks for the reward of the carrots. He thinks if he pokes the stick in one corner, they'll hop over to the corner where the carrots are. But the trouble with this argument is that the U.S. economy is not a rabbit cage. And business people, entrepreneurs especially, don't respond well to prods from a stick. Any stick. If they get a glimpse of the rod, they'll leap away for sure. But it might just be to somewhere outside the United States. Our cage. And the carrots of cheaper labor overseas might even be tastier. Maybe the president is forgetting the goal, which is making the economy grow faster. Enough carrots and businesses will grow, and they'll create jobs. But pick up even a few sticks and you won't get recovery. Instead, we'll all be looking at an empty cage and asking, where are the rabbits?
Amity Schles is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's a big football game this Sunday, Super Bowl XLV, whatever it is, 46, I think. Giants-Patriots, as you know. But we all know all the hoopla is not really about the game. It's about the ads, the millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of ads. And if that's your measure, the clear winner of last year's game was this one.
The little kid is wandering around his house. And he is dressed in the little miniature Darth Vader's costume, but he's obviously powerless because he's just a little boy. And then his father comes home driving a new Passat, and he rushes past his dad to get out and use his force. We then see in the kitchen the father uses his key fob that allows you to start your car remotely.
And the kid, of course, jumped out of his skin, if you remember that ad. That guy talking was Mark Hunter. He's the chief creative officer at Deutsch LA, the ad agency that came up with that VW ad. Earlier this week, I went out to Mark's office to see what they got cooked up for this year.
Things have changed in Super Bowl advertising. It used to be about a kind of one-time sort of hit for 30 seconds or 60 seconds in the middle of the show. And, you know, increasingly, we're trying to create like a sort of a two-week buzz around a 60-second piece of communication.
Which is no mean feat. So here we are. So you guys, we're gonna see the ad.
You're going to see the ad.
And then I want to talk through the process of how you follow up what was the ad coming out of the Super Bowl, which is the ad event of the past year, okay?
Fantastic.
So let's hit what we got.
So this was a teaser that we released, and in a way, this was the opening salvo of the 2012 Super Bowl Olympic ad war.
I just got it. Back and better than ever. 2-5-12. That's all. That was awesome. It takes you a minute to realize that they're doing the Darth Vader theme, right?
It does.
But that's great.
We've come to, when we show it now, we tend not to look at the screen. We look at people's faces. And there is that moment of recognition about 7 seconds in.
Now, the premise of having a teaser for an ad campaign. Aren't ad campaigns in and of themselves teasers?
Yes, actually. The way in which people advertise in the Super Bowl was kind of developed before there was an internet, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things that we did last year, and I don't think we're overstating it by saying we pioneered this, is we pre-released our ad. This year, of course, what's happened is everyone will pre-release. Literally,
right.
I suspect there will not be an ad you'll see on Super Bowl that wasn't available online. So our feeling was, if you want to stay ahead of the curve, and if no one is pre-releasing, let's pre-release. If everyone is pre-releasing, let's do a pre-release.
Oh, my God.
I know. It gets a bit.
Right?
Let's
yeah.
tease.
It's like the presidential campaign.
Exactly.
Never
it's like
ends,
two
right?
years of campaign.
Yeah.
Quite, you know.
Obviously, a huge opportunity coming out of last year's Darth Vader ad. Does that make this campaign more emotional for you guys? I mean, is it harder now because there's so much attention?
The biggest question this year for us was, well, firstly, how do you follow up something like that?
Yeah, right. How did you do it? Did you sit down with a focus group and show them, you know, the 2011 ad with Darth Vader and then say, what'd you guys like, and then build on themes? Or did you just get some of your own smart people in a room and say, let's figure this out?
Yeah, we tend to go for the our own smart people in a room sort of angle. You know, we looked at this every way possible, and there was a group of people who thought, let's just walk away and let's just do something different. The other one was to do part two. You know, what's this kid doing now, you know? The third way was to maybe find a kind of a fresh and different way that kept the linkage to the Star Right. Wars franchise alive. That ad last year was lovable. But you also don't want to underestimate the power when you get into social media, of that Star Wars community. I mean, you know, there are people.
Oh,
yes. We don't just throw it on YouTube and cross our fingers. So it's no surprise then that we sort of arrived at the third way. And based on that teaser, unsurprisingly, has a link to dogs,
yeah.
Which
right,
after Star Wars is another fairly large community
within
social media.
That's
I tell you what, we stayed away from cats because our feeling was that VW was much more of a dog brand.
Mark Hunter, thanks very much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
So that, I guess, was a teaser in itself because we didn't play the ad. If you want to see this year's VW ad and a couple of other pre-released ads from Sunday as well, they're on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, two items from the world of bankruptcy court. First of all, American Airlines. We learned today parent company AMR, which is in Chapter 11, has asked for permission to cut 13,000 jobs and eliminate a couple of big employee pension plans. Also, Kodak, the company said in a filing in bankruptcy court this week, it can't afford the, quote, significant annual fee to keep its name on the Kodak Theater in Hollywood. That's where the Oscars are. So landlords have, like, what, a couple of weeks to come up with a new name. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 83 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ tacked on 34 points, about 1.2%. The S&P 500 rose 11 points, 0.9%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. Coming up next time, Nevada has suffered more than most this recession, which leaves new college graduates without a whole lot of options.
It's very disheartening to have worked so hard for 4 or 5 years and you're ready for the world and the world just kind of doesn't want you and you just kind of don't have those options. And so it's very disheartening.
The Real Economy, our coverage of what really matters in this election continues. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.